So I'm in the library at Adishtana with Jyoti Parla. So we're at the end of this White Tara retreat with the Santra. Just thought it might be quite nice to start now and ask you how it's been being here this week.
I never find Adishtana comfortable. Padmaloka I find comfortable, but Adishtana I don't. Of course, it's too not lived in enough for me. So Padmaloka's had 4 decades to soften and become more comfortable.
Round the edges off.
Yes, a bit, yes. So it feels a bit sterile at times and a bit alienated at times, I feel, here at Adishtana compared with. That's the only thing I can compare it with. Except that, well, Rivendell and Vajraloka, they were all right.
Did they go through a process of softening? And
yeah, I presume they will in decades to come. It'll be a beautiful place, you know.
What about retreat-wise? How's it been for you retreat-wise?
Well, my meditations, I'm not a brilliant meditator. I used to think I would be a good meditator and not a scholar, but time has proved me wrong, and I'm not a scholar, I'm not a meditator. I'm more, actually, by temperament, a japawala, that is, just chanting mantras. So that's what I do. That's what I'm best at. Yeah. It seems. I mean, I could be wrong, but, I mean, capacity for self-delusion is infinite, isn't it?
So what was the word you used? Japawala?
Yeah, it's an Indian expression. People who just... Japa is just repeating a sound. Or silently, or out loud.
So where did it all start for you, this Dharma life?
My real Dharma life started when I was a teenager. I was raised a Catholic, and I was an altar boy, and was educated in secondary school by the De La Salle brothers. And when I was 14, I think, I went to their junior novitiate to become a De La Salle brother, to join their order. I was there for 3 years, till sex raised its ugly head, and then beautiful head, whatever that may be. And then I left when I was in the Scholastica. And then again, when I was in America, in Las Vegas, I started to read Thomas Merton's book, and all my Catholicism came back, and I was inspired by Thomas Merton to go to a relatively recently new monastery in Utah called Our Lady of the Holy Trinity. I went there to become a Trappist monk. You know.
So you see that as your first Dharma life?
Yes, I think it is. I think for me, what we referred to as ultimate reality has to be the same experience, because as human beings, we all have the same faculties. So we all more or less experience the same thing. How we interpret that experience will differ depending on our worldview, and particularly our concepts and beliefs. And for Buddhism, it's enlightenment or ultimate reality. For theists, it's a vision of God. And there's all different kinds of understandings of it, you know, of what that experience is. But
so how do you come to be in the order rather than being a Trappist monk?
Well, I left that Trappist monk after about 3 years, came back to England. Got married, moved to Brighton. And when I was in Brighton, I started doing yoga, Hatha Yoga. There was a beautiful air hostess who was leading the yoga in this front room of this bungalow near Preston Park. So she was gorgeous. I was married at the time, but the attraction was obviously a motivating force to my doing the yoga. But at the same time, there was this one front room. There was another front room over here to the bungalow. Jim Martin, the guy, was the Brighton Buddhist Society. And Buddhadasa had recently started running meditation classes there. And in the same bungalow. And quite often at the same time, the same night. And eventually I got tired of the yoga for one reason or another and went over to the Buddhist side to meditate with Buddhadasa. And interestingly, about couple of weeks before I came along, Padma Vajra came along to the same place. So he's senior to me in the Dharma. And this was 1974. This time of year-ish, you know, September, October, November, I can't remember. So he was about 2 or 3 weeks ahead of me, and he plugged straight into the Dharma, and that where I went for the yoga and the air hostess, he went for the Dharma. It's been the story of my life. My whole life could be summed up in that two approaches, those two beings.
What was your first impression of Buddhadasa?
I don't know. I don't have one. I don't. He seemed a reasonably enough guy, you know. A bit stiff and formal, I felt.
Do you remember what he was teaching?
Well, shortly after that, we moved. We got our own premises in George's Street, and there we used to have a regular class, so we'd do a period of meditation, and we'd listen to one of Bantik's talks. Well, we did that in Jim Martin's bungalow, but they bored the pants off me, so I asked him, could we get listen to some tapes by somebody else other than this guy? Because just so his voice, but I found out his voice so boring and droning on, and I used to fall asleep regularly.
So what kept you coming then?
Well, it was a puja, I think, that he did once, and I think what it did was it enabled me to express that religious side of my temperament, which had been there from a very early age, from 11 or 12 year old, you know, as an altar boy, enabled me to express that in a way which I found just as strong as any church ritual, and that even more so, in fact, touched me emotionally. It was the puja that did that. I've always been more of a devotional type than an intellectual type. Well, you generalise, but that's obviously not true, but it's because it's a generalisation. But
so in what way is it not that, true?
What?
In what way is that not true?
Well, I think all generalisations have flaws in them. Then they never quite... See, I've learned through time that my own assessment of myself and my tendencies are flawed. I've got it wrong. So this designation of myself as a devotional type could be equally wrong. But I'm working with it as a provisional designation of who I am. Because we all like to pigeonhole ourselves and say I'm this sort of person. We just do, that's what we do, isn't it? You know, everybody does it, whether they admit it or not. They still do that. They've got this idea of themselves fitting into a certain conceptual box, which they can understand then. It helps them to understand in a certain level who they are from a certain perspective. Whether that's true or not, that's irrelevant. But what I'm just saying is that, you know, pigeonholing yourself and giving yourself a I'm this sort of person is a common human trait, which we all do it, you know, on one level.
I guess, I was interested in, you were saying you feel that you're primarily devotional, but that isn't the whole story. No, so to put it another way, what was it about the movement, the order that drew you that you didn't keep you with Catholicism?
I was just saying that at the table there, because Buddhism in Brighton, the after repeal Buddhism in Brighton, didn't appear to have any moral code. And I loved that. And to me, Buddhism didn't have morality. That's what I understood. Because the bunch of us there that were attracted to Buddhism there were a very, by and large, hedonistic lot, all into sex, drugs and rock and roll. Well, it was the time of the decade when...
So this is the mid-70s?
Yes, 74, 75. So that's where it seemed. I mean, later on, of course, I was saying that I did, when it came to my ordination, I didn't even know I was going to be ordained before I went on the retreat. And halfway through the retreat, Bhante said, "I've decided to ordain you." But when he said that, I had no idea what the 10 precepts were. I had no idea. All I'd been in contact with the 5 precepts, and they didn't seem to matter, the 5 precepts. You know, people had just been paying attention to them.
So you didn't actually ask for ordination?
I did ask, but I thought, well, why not, you know.
So when did you ask?
A few months before, I think, earlier in the year. Well, over the winter, I think, when Bounty came to give a series of talks in Brighton, maybe the end of 75. I can't remember.
It was 1976, and the Pavilion, the Brighton lectures.
Yes, yeah, the New Society lectures, yes. Yeah, they're out of fashion these days, but there's a lot in those lectures, I think.
Well, they're going to be talking about Blueprint for a New Society this weekend, on the Young People's Weekend.
Yeah, it's a very powerful thing, a very powerful concept of creating where the Sangha will... The whole idea was to try to maintain you as much as possible within the milieu of the Sangha, which will you will give to it, and it will give what you can to it, and it will give you what you need back in return, and that your needs, emotional and everything, will be met within there. Unfortunately, it hadn't worked out that way for many people. But that was Bandy's vision, and it's a beautiful vision. And I still think that that's what we should be aiming for, where we look after one another and nurture one another and love one another as much as possible.
So it was those lectures that led you to ask for ordination?
No, I don't think so, no. No, I think I wanted to be ordained so everybody was in this Tibetan stuff then and thinking, I just want an exotic visualization practice or something. That was all it was. I mean, in those days, as mitras, we did stupa visualization and Shakyamuni visualization as mitras. Regularly we did them. So, but that wasn't exotic enough for me, you see. Well, it was sort of spiritual materialism gone mad. We wanted more and more and more and more.
So what happened when you were ordained and you were given an exotic practice?
Well, it felt all right, but then my marriage broke up. I was married then to my first wife. And after a couple of months, I came home from work. I was a painter and decorator in Brighton. And she packed all my bags and all my things in two bin liners, big bin liners, said, scoot. She just felt threatened by it all. Because that was almost every night I was down the centre, you know.
So what did you do?
Well, I went and moved into the centre there. Yeah. But then a month or so later, after barely existing in the centre, then doing my job and things, and then I was giving her some money, and she didn't think it was enough, and she came one night and threw a brick through the centre window, smashed it. Huge plate glass window. It would be in a shop. And so I figured out how much it was. I gave Buddhadasa the money for it, so she wouldn't be liable for it. And I hopped it to Sakabati to pack my bags and just said goodbye, Brett, and I went to... didn't even give notice at work that I was quitting. Just went straight to Sakabati, take to Bandy. And Bandy said, they're a bit short of people in Glasgow. Why don't you go there? So I hitched up to Glasgow. Vajradhakini, was it? The one that's living with Perna now in New Zealand, or what?
Marlini.
Was it Marlini?
Yeah, it was Marlini. She's married to Perna.
She was there. Brian lasted a week there. And I got a letter from Nagabodhi, who was chair of Ariatara, asking me if I wanted to join the community there. So I didn't like the idea of Glasgow. I didn't know what I'd do in Glasgow.
So were there for 2 weeks?
Something like that. Spending a lot of time in pubs, as we did in those days, and night time. So. And then moved into Ariatara.
So when was that, about 77?
It had to be 70. Well, it was the end of 76. When it actually, a lot happened in 76. I got ordained, got chucked out by my wife, went to Glasgow, saw that lot there, didn't like it. Naga Bodhi asked me to come to Ariatara, moved into Ariatara, all happened towards the end of 76.
So can I just take you back to your actual ordination? So you were on a retreat already, and Bantu said he was going to ordain you.
Mm.
So what happened? Were other people ordained? How did it happen?
Oh, no, just me. Ah. I was the first person to be ordained at Padmaloka. Nobody had been ordained there before.
Ah.
I was the very first person then. No, it's just me. Bhante sort of did that in those days. He would just there wasn't an ordination process or anything like that. Whenever Bhante felt like you were ready, you considered you ready.
Do you remember the ceremonies?
Oh yeah, yeah. Because I didn't know what I was doing. Basically, I was totally confused. I was told to, for the private ordination, I had to come down some stairs and find this little room where Bhante standing there. Like an icicle. I thought, who's this guy? So I didn't know him at all well. You know, I wasn't one of his inner circle. And I always found him a bit odd, a bit distant. I never got on well with him, really. I mean, got pissed off with him several times, but I was never really close with him. But I learned later to appreciate him. It's only in hindsight that I appreciated Bhante. It's only when I was in the wilderness that I really appreciated Bhante.
So that's a bit later on in the story.
Yes.
So how did you come to the wilderness?
Well, I'd been in India. Bhante asked me to set up Vajraloka. He asked me to do that. So I went and joined the building team there. And I was going to start leading retreats there. And then Kamala Sheela wrote to me and asked me if he could join me in there. And I said, sure, yeah, come on. So he did. But then when the building work had finished and we were starting on retreats, the thing came, who's going to be chairman? So we flipped a coin and said, well, you go this time and I'll go next time as chairman, because who's going to be chairman? But Subhuti and the gang up in LBC appointed him the chairman, which really pissed me off. And I felt I had been totally pushed out, especially since I was the one that Bhante had asked to get the whole thing up and running. So I went to Bhante. I said, I've just got to get out of here. And so he said, what are you going to do? I said, well, maybe I'll just wander around. And he says, why don't you wander around in India? I said, oh, okay then. So then he said, you might want to become an Arigarika as well. So I became an Arigarika. That's why I went to India.
And how long were you in India for?
Well, I was there from like 80, 81 to 88, almost non-stop with one break. And then I went back to England and worked for Windows for a while, but I hated that then. But then I went back to India on 3 6-month tours. But then I just got totally fed up. And I was a lot on my own in India.
So what were you doing?
Teaching the Dharma.
All by yourself?
A lot of the time, yes. I was on tours. Lokamitra Mitra would send me on tours, you know, with a bunch of Buddha Yarn magazines and a couple of order members or mitras to support me and translate for me. Then he sent me up to Shravasti, the Chinese temple. He was hoping to get a hold of it for the order. I spent 6 months there because I was in robes. I was like a robe there. The local bhikkhu who'd temporary ownership of it was happy to have her. But I was living there all by myself in the Chinese, a huge temple there. And then for some reason I had to go back to Aurangabad where I was stationed. Spent a year there, but then I went up and spent a whole year in the Chinese temple at Shravasti as the robe there. But in the end, it just wore me out.
So what were you doing when you were being the robe in the Chinese temple at Shravasti?
I had nothing to do except practice, you know.
So you're meditating?
Meditating, chanting, doing a lot of chanting, you know. Talking to the occasional people who came to see me, trying to keep out of the way of snakes. But towards the end, when it just really got to me, the isolation and the and no support. And I got dysentery twice, which nearly killed me. I was stung twice by scorpions, which nearly killed me. And in the end, I just had enough. And then my mum got ill in South Africa. She was in there in South with my sister. So I just went out to her, you know, and I think I'm not going to sit to myself, I'm not going back there. I felt like I was treated like a thing, a commodity.
In India?
Yeah. Mm. It's my own fault. I tend to say yes too easily. I mean, what was the point of me being in Shravasti for all year? I don't know.
So in amidst all this, what would you say your sense was of going for refuge? Did you think in those terms?
Never. I never felt going for refuge. Never felt. I just was ordained into the order. That's how it was. Mm. Nobody talked about going for refuge when I was first ordained. Mm. You just joined the order. That was it. It was like a step up. It was like a status symbol. Like it was the promotion almost, isn't it? Mm. People saw it, in, I think, in those sort of... Maybe some saw it in the others, but I didn't, being a gross person I am. I just saw it in, you know, it's the next thing.
So when you went to South Africa, was that when you resigned?
No, I came back from South Africa after going. My sister, who's a Durban City Councillor, whose political allegiance was to the right of Adolf Hitler, spent years in number four at my Meta Bhavna. But anyway, so I came back to England, worked for Windhorst Trading.
In Cambridge?
Met a certain Lady Mitra, moved in with her for a year. But then it occurred to me while I was living with her that what I needed to do was I needed to go back to India and face my demons there. It's like falling off a horse. You've got to get back up again, aren't you? So I knew I had to go back to it. So this time I'd disrobed and I was in civvies. So I went back to India. Again, where was I? I was basically in Aurangabad. But again, I was moved around doing programs and things like that. But I was more in control of it this time.
How was it going back to India?
It was difficult because everybody still called me Banti Jyotipal. And, you know, I wasn't a Banti anymore. I wasn't in robes. It had its difficulties. And when I got back, I realised, you know, India without robes was the pits. You know, you just... I realised what a fool I'd been to disrobe. You know. Even the lady I was with, I loved her tenderly, but my tendencies, you see, my tendencies tend to take over, lead me beyond the realms of reason. Anyway, so after 3 years, again it got too much for me, so I came back. So while I was doing that, I was also living at Rivendell, first of all, and help with Satya Bandhu, who I loved dearly. We shared a room together. Lovely bloke. And we got on really well, actually. You know, strange bedfellows, as they say, but we got on really well. You know, like he was my brother, you know. It was really great. And then it was suggested by, I think, Nagabodha, that I should be in Padmaloka. So I asked if I could join the community, and I joined the Padmaloka community, and...
So when would that have been? It must be in the 80s by
now. 93, 92, 93. 92-ish. Because 93, 92, 93, I think, I went to Guyaloka on the team there, you know, of the team. But by this time, I still felt isolated. I think what shook me more than anything, looking back now, is the resignation of Padma Raja. He'd been my best mate.
Ah.
And while I was in India, at the Chinese temple, all on my own, I received a letter mentioning, this is the way I read it, that Padma Raja has resigned. Well, I thought it said, as chairman of Croydon. But not, he'd resigned from the order. Mm. And it was only on the second reading, my brain wouldn't take it in, that he'd resigned. And it... The floor went out of my world in a lot of things.
So when did you meet him first, Padma Raja?
Oh, when I moved into Ariyatara, when Nagabodhi asked me to go there in the end of 76. Mm. Yeah. Yeah, I'd known him from then, you know.
What was he like?
Lovely guy. I really liked him, yeah.
How would you describe him?
Just very easy to be around. He was just very easy, very down to earth, but very spiritually motivated at the same time. That was then. I mean, when he became a sort of megalomaniac, you know, a sort of power freak.
Did you know him then?
No, I didn't. I was in India that time when that happened.
I see. Yeah.
I sometimes wonder if I would have allowed that time. Would I have spoken up and said anything? I don't know. But he was just a lovely guy to be around. I really enjoyed his company, you know.
Mm. So where have we got to in the story?
I'm back. I'm back in England. I'm at Rivendell, then I'm at Padmanoka. Mm. But at the same time, I started to fall in love with this. I'd already started a relationship with this Mitra from Croydon, who I'd met through Rivendell. And I really got obsessed with her. I wanted to move in with her, marry her, and all. Story of my life. So I did. And when I got back for India one time, almost every member of the order team, although officially I wasn't on the team, but I was, had been made a private preceptor, but I hadn't. And that really pissed me off. I was pissed off with Banti and for the guys there for actually letting that happen while I was away. You know what I mean?
This was the guys at Padmaloka?
Yeah. Mm. Well, I didn't say, well, what about Jyotipala? Why didn't they stick up for me?
Mm. So did you ever find out what happened?
No. What I've tended to do by and large in my life is when a situation gets toxic, I just move out. I don't really blame anybody because it doesn't get you anywhere to cause a mess and be negative. The best thing is to get out of the toxic situation. So eventually I did. So I moved in with this lady in Croydonish, and that was the end of my career. So in a sense, that this was in 94. So basically that was almost about the end of my order career because I had no real contact with the order after that. And we moved to Ireland, me and my lady. And there she was very anti the order. So in the end, she convinced me to resign from the order. So in 2002, we were going to go to New Zealand for a year, a year's contract. And so I went to Banti and thanked him for everything and said, I'm going to resign. Oh, that was that. So that was it. So that was the beginning of my time in the wilderness, as I call it.
Did it feel like a wilderness?
At times it did, yeah. Because I realised, especially when my relationship with this lady got tenuous and messy, and then we tried to mend it by getting officially married, which was a disaster, that I'd made a mistake, that they were my real family. This was my real family. And I spent a lot of time looking around, spent a lot of time with Throstle Hole, especially when this marriage ended. I just moved into Throstle Hole for 6 months, spent 6 months there. And then for the next 8 or 9 years, I spent the time, 3 or 4 sessions a year, spent a lot of time there.
So what was it like at Throstle Hole?
Oh, it was great. Yeah, it was really great. Really fitted in there, so to say, yeah.
So what was it like to practice there?
It was much simpler than the order. They only have one practice, that is just sitting. They don't have any other practices.
So you did that for 6 months and then...
Yes. Well, we had to all get out. There was a whole bunch of us there in 2008 who were sort of all of us, you know, at a loose end in our various lives. We all had to go, because they closed down the monastery to visitors during the December and January, you know. So the monks can just have it to themselves, you know. So I said, well, I thought of becoming a monk, but my health took a turn for the worse. So I phoned up these people, the council, and got a flat in Haltwhistle, which is only about 15 miles away from Throstle, so I could go backwards and forth relatively easily. So I spent about 8 years there, and always going to Drosserhoe. And then, all of a sudden, in 16, two phone calls happened.
2016?
Yeah, 2016. Mm-hmm. One was both from Drosserhoe. Reverend Eleanor, she wrote up, and she said, we've had a request from somebody called Loka Mitra, who wants to know where you live and what you're for. Can we give him your phone number? I said, yes, of course. And then a week later, and then this ex-monk called Roswita, she lives in Berlin, actually, now, wants you to know, can we give her your number? I said, yes. So what's going on? And then I received a card from Padma Vajra. Couple of months later. Oh, I must say, about a couple of years before that, in one of my sober moments, of not alcoholically, but emotionally, I'd realised what an idiot I'd been in resigning, you know, what childish, immature person. So I wrote to Bhante saying, I just want to say, you know, thank you for all you've given me, and just let people know in the order that I'm sorry if I've caused anybody any hurt by resigning. He sent me a lovely letter back, you know. So that was that. And so then a couple of years later, those two phone calls, and then a month or so later on, postcard from Padma Vajra, and then I wrote back, and then he wrote back to me, and then said, why don't you come to Padma Loka to spend time with me? So I did. And then I said, I've been a right idiot, you know. I'd really like to. And he said, and he says, well, why didn't you come back sooner? I said, well, I honestly didn't think anybody would want me back in the order. That's what I felt.
Gosh.
You can get like that, you know, mm-hmm. when you're in the wilderness. That's what I mean by the wilderness, you know, when you think that, you know. Nobody in my family, I've sort of left my family, and they obviously won't want me back, you know. What use am I here? And so that was the rest is history. I went on a couple of retreats and then got ordained in March, reordained in March 17. Only public ordination, because Bhante told Padma Vajra that I didn't need a private ordination, because he felt we'd been in contact throughout my time in the wilderness.
Mm.
He felt the two of us had actually been, which is true in a sense, because I had always thought of him as my teacher, even though I was like an idiot wandering around in the wilderness, like idiots do, you know. Mm.
And how's it been since then, since you rejoined the order?
Well, it's good. I moved to Newcastle to be near the centre because it was too far to travel, but this year I've stopped going there. Yeah.
Are you in a chapter?
Oh yeah, but only one really. It's mainly just a Cooper and me. He comes to my place every Wednesday.
Mm.
And Dee Chitrica, our new order member, the delightful Dee Chitrica.
Oh, I met her on the international gathering. She was sat in front of me. She's a painter, isn't she?
She is. She's lovely. Mm. She's lovely. She comes and sees me every Tuesday afternoon. We have a lovely old natter there together. Mm. We're really good pals now.
So how would you describe your Dharma practice these days? What do you do?
Well, my main Dharma practice these days is a sort of just sitting. I'm very much into the view of reality as being non-dual, which is quite legitimate. Advaita Chitta, as Bhante puts it in the book From Genesis to the Diamond Sutra. So I see these things this way, and so I've immersed myself in Hindu non-dual literature because it's the plainest than Buddhist stuff. The Buddhist stuff is too gobbledygooky for me, but the Hindu stuff is very, very clear and straightforward. So I basically do just sitting, and that's my main practice, and chanting mantras. Tara Mantra or the Guru Yoga. Sometimes I do Guru Yoga. I'm going on again. I went on Guru Yoga retreat with Padma last year, and I'm going on the one at Padma Loka next month with him. So I do that practice. But I don't do tarot visualization. I probably, I better not say it. If I say I probably won't do the white tarot sadhana, then I probably means I probably will at some point.
So what made you come on this retreat?
I don't know. No idea. I think I just wanted, now that I'm not going to the centre, I thought I needed direct order contact with order members. Even if it's in silence, you know, it's still contact, you know, there's still something happens when we're together, you know, which is amazing, really, you know, when you think of it, you know. So, yes, so I'm at home there, available to people if they want me. Sometimes people ring me up and come and see me.
So can I ask you something completely different? Can I ask you about your name?
Jyotipala.
Yeah. What does it mean and what does it mean to you?
Well, Jyoti means brightness. It's a girl's name, actually. Loka Mitra's missus, her sister is called Jyoti. Pali's protector, so I'm supposed to, Brandy in my ordination said I'm supposed to be the protector of the brightness of the Dharma and to sort of keep it lively and bright and not doer, and I don't know whether I do that. I don't like doerness. I have my doer side, everybody has it. But there you go. I've noticed that actually. When I think back, I think that actually I haven't. In 45 years of Dharma practice, I don't think I've changed at all. I think I'm just the same as I was then.
What about your relationship to the precepts now?
I see them now as quite valuable, actually. I tend to think of them as, because I'm aware of my own particular, or too much so, actually, my own tendencies, I cannot rely on my own judgment all the time to be a guideline for me. I just can't. I just know I can't. Because it's caused me so much trouble one way or another. So without having the precepts as a framework in which to live, well, I'd probably be dead by now anyway. Drunk in a gutter somewhere in a fight, knife fight probably. The truth were known, but because of the precepts, and I'm not saying I always observe them, I don't, but I do value them, I do see their value in them. Not just their value, their essentiality, they're absolutely essential. Dr. Ambedkar was really clear on this. He said, society isn't sufficient. What is needed is a religious background, which has a moral framework. Otherwise, every citizen would need a policeman to monitor them. And who would monitor the police? That was Dr. Ambedkar's insight, and it's very true. So that's why he picked on Buddhism. Because Hinduism doesn't really have a very strong moral. It has a caste system code, which is their dharma, their morality, but not really, as far as I know, a strict moral code like Christianity and Buddhism has, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And it's laid out like this. This is that's the bottom line. You know, you don't kill. You know, you don't steal. You know, you don't commit sexual misconduct.
So when you were on these preaching tours in India, what were you teaching? What were you preaching?
Just the very basic stuff, actually. Going for refuge. What it means to be a bodhisattva, you can do that because they call Dr. Ambedkar the bodhisattva Dr. Ambedkar. So you can use that. And what's a bodhisattva and how do you become a bodhisattva? And that leads into puja, it talks on puja. And puja is a mean of developing the bodhisattva spirit. And I keep it very, very simple, you know. And the difference between Buddhism and Buddha Dharma, what's the difference between them? Is there a difference? You know? I had a whole notebook of talks, and I used to give the same talks over and over again, village after village and things like that, same talk. And I would never No, which talk I was going to give until I saw the crowd in front of me. Then I would decide. It would occur to me intuitively what talk to give to this particular thing. So I never prepared a talk for a particular thing. I had my talks. And I preferred question and answer sessions to talks, because I can rabbit on forever once I'm asked questions. I can just go on and on.
So what would you say if you were giving a talk on going for refuge?
Giving
a? A talk on going for refuge. What would you say?
Well, I would say, you know, what does it mean to go for refuge? Yeah. What is it? What is it going for refuge? Yeah? And I used to say, you know, you have to take something that you value. What do you value most in your life? What is it that you value most in your life? And I'd say things like, now these days most people value money more than anything else. So that instead of having Vishnu or something like Shiva in the temple, they should have a big rupee note there, because that's what they actually worship. They don't worship Shiva. They're just going there to ask them to give them money or whatever. So what do you value? I said, going for refuge. So that's what going for refuge means. And most refuge, because we have got to realise that most people, and in the West people go for refuge to sex, drugs and rock and roll, to sort of get them through the night. That's our three jewels, sex, drugs and rock and roll. So in India I'd say, you know, if you're going to go for refuge to the Buddha, that means the most important thing in your life has to be becoming more and more like the Buddha. That must be central in your life, and changing society around you to help to bring that around. Going for refuge to the Dharma means not just reading Dr. Ambedkar's work, but actually practicing what Dr. Ambedkar taught in Buddha and his Dhamma, his main book. And what is Sangha? Well, that's what we're offering you in Tri Ratna. In Tri Ratna, we're offering you the opportunity to practice the Dhamma together so that you can become like Dr. Babasaheb Ambedkar and the Buddha and things like that. So I keep it simple like that. I'll elaborate all those. But I keep it very, very simple and down to earth and realistic, you know, which is in their life. And I'd rail against their drinking. And I remember one village, all the women wore veils. Buddhists, what are you women hiding for? Because they lived in a predominantly Muslim area, you see. And if they didn't wear veils, the Muslims thought they were loose women. They would categorise them as prostitutes or something. Buddhist women wearing veils. So I'd use those little things like that too.
What was your favourite talk that you'd give? Did you have a favourite topic?
I don't think so, no, I don't think. I can't remember now, it's ages ago since I did it, but I probably did, but...
So you had a whole bunch of talks?
Yeah.
And then you just...
Yeah, so I didn't have to worry, because quite often you were asked to give a talk that you hadn't bargained for, and then if you didn't have a talk ready, you're at the Swanee. That in my book, and by the time I left India, it was all in tatters, you know, because I'd used it to an exercise book, you know, I'd written them all out in and a pointer.
Is there anything I haven't asked you about Dharma life that you think is important to talk about?
One thing that I was surprised at when I came back in the order was that the order hadn't matured enough so that women were ordaining men and men were ordaining women. I think that is a lack of maturity somewhere. There's something wrong there. That isn't happening. This should happen quite naturally, but it isn't.
Because?
I don't know. It's just my...
No, why is it natural?
I don't know. It just seems not quite natural to me. I think it's because I was heavily influenced by Throstle Hole, who have... men and women monks. They don't call them monks until they call them monks. And women can ordain men and men can ordain women. Eh? You see what I mean? So have evidence for it and see that it actually works. You know, it's fine. You know, and what's all this hang-up for? Yeah, there'll be abuses, but the system as it is has abuses within it. So of course you would get abuses in mixed sex thing. Of course. Why? Because we're human beings. I mean, to expect to have a spiritual community without abuse and failings in it is pie in the sky. We're human beings. We're not saints. God help us. Why don't people get real? We're human beings. We have needs. We have sexual needs. We have emotional needs. We have all kinds of needs. They have to be met within the Sangha so that people don't go out the Sangha and dissipate their energies. Another big thing, being my body, which I realized last year when I was on retreat at Padmalaka, we have to share. We have to share our insights with one another and not keep them preciously to ourselves, because we've no Banti anymore to inspire us with his insights. So our insights have to come from ourselves, from us. We have to share totally and fully, no holding back. We have to be really honest and straight with one another. And yeah, we'll make mistakes and some of our insights will be wrong. So what? Who gives a damn? I mean, we're just human beings. I think sometimes people forget that we're human beings. They concentrate too much on the order member and not enough on the fact that they're just human beings. Same as the other 7.5 billion people on this planet. No different. The same drives and tendencies. No different at all. No different from the Muslims or the Hindus or the Christians and that. All the same. Bottom line. We're humans.
So would you say that's one of your insights?
I think so, yeah. That's one of my insights. And we have to share his insight.
And are there
We're all in the same boat. We're all suffering in one form or another. We all find life unsatisfactory. And we're all seeking solutions to alleviate that suffering. All of us. So my bottom line is, what I say to people is, whatever gets you through the night, do it. I don't give a damn what it is. If it gets you through the night, in my book, that's fine. Because we're just human beings with a short space of time. I just want people to be happy and not hung up on their beliefs and opinions. Just human beings. Just so that we can be happy and at peace with one another. Cut out the bullshit. That's number one. Anyway.
Thank you.